Support for Commodity Week comes from the Friends of WILL and from Strategic Farm Marketing in Champaign. With crop insurance, grain marketing, and commodity brokerage services. Learn more at sfarmmarketing.com.
This is the July 7 edition of Commodity Week.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Welcome to Commodity Week. I am Todd Gleason. Our panelists today include Dan Zwicker at Zwicker Consulting out of Waco, Texas, and Jerry Gulke of the Gulke Group from Chicago, Illinois. Commodity Week is a production of Illinois Public Media. Look us up online at willag.org. You can listen to us as a podcast as well. Search iTunes or these other places for Commodity Week and the Closing Market Report, Stitcher, Google Play, and of course the NPR One app. Well, let's begin by getting ourselves set technically. We're joined, of course, by Jerry Gulke and Dan Zwicker. Dan, you told us you were going to try to do some extra things as we finished up this week and got the numbers in. We got another 15 cents up in the soybeans. Where do we set in the major commodities on the technical side at this time?
Okay, before I take off on that, I guess this is kind of a disclaimer here. So, people kind of remember the first thing you say and maybe the last thing you say. first thing I want to point out is 29 out of 39 years of data that I've been watching, December corn futures has had a top in the calendar year by middle July. So then there was like a couple August highs, then there maybe was like a September high, and then you get into the short crop years where you have highs in October and November and December where you have the short crop long tail scenario. Soybeans is pretty much the same story, 28 years out of 39 years, November soybeans have had a calendar year high in the market by mid-July. And then again, you'll see a couple in September, maybe then you go into November type thing. So percentage-wise, you know, in another week or two, 75% of our calendar year highs are in place on an average, but we can get lost in averages. So the big question, I guess, is this going to be a short crop that takes us higher into the fall, or is it going to be somewhat seasonal in nature, where you put a high in during July, and then you tail off as you go on into the harvest. So I think that tells you that next week's weather pattern is probably key. The way I'm reading it today is that one model implies one thing and one model implies the other, and I guess it depends upon which ones we get. Now, taking a look at basically, the chart pattern, as I mentioned yesterday, if you wanted to use this gap up that we had on Monday as a measuring gap off of the most recent low, that kind of laid the groundwork for a December corn futures for a push to 414 or so. We didn't quite get there today. But I did think I don't know what the high is, but we did, I think, punch out that 407 high that we had here a week or two ago.
It was 409 today.
Yeah, 409. So we're within a nickel of that. Like I said, plus or minus a nickel, or depending on what next week's weather is, 50 cents, I guess. Now, if you look at the December corn futures, kind of on a weekly chart, You can actually, or maybe you can see a flag formation. Let me pull that up here. Actually, it is a daily chart. You could probably use the high that we had here on Monday, and then we had an inside day on Wednesday, and then we kind of had a decline, a sharply lower decline during the overnight session on Wednesday night, and then Thursday we came back and we kind of closed within a couple cents lower. Then today, now we have broken out above that Monday's high. So if you kind of want to use that as maybe a flag formation, so you take the midpoint of this week's range and basically go down to the bottom that we had here at 374 here, you can measure the next move up in December corn would be 427. And I did look at a couple other angles, and there was another way of getting to about 4.25. So that would be the immediate near-term upside objectives, I guess. We come in here Sunday night, and the weather maps are indicating that we're going to have above normal temperatures and below normal precip as the bulk of the corn starts entering the tasseling and silking stages next week. Then on a cyclical basis, I'm just going to take corn and then I'm going to stop. On a cyclical basis, I think you want to use, let me pull up my other charting package here. The low that we made here a couple weeks ago, or you can kind of use that as maybe a 40 to 45 week cycle low. And we are in the early stages of an uptrending 40 to 45 week cycle that could take us higher, probably as we go all the way into next winter, next spring. So that would imply that the market is just kind of getting warmed up, and I guess the crop is going to get smaller from here. I think the lows that were put in place a year ago or back the last day of August of 2016, I think that'll go down as a major yearly cycle low. So from a cyclical basis, the foundation technically and cyclically, the market is in position to climb higher. The question is, I guess, is how the fundamentals are going to unfold and what it takes to get a major bull market going in corn over the next several months. And therefore, I'll toss it over to Jerry.
Well, first, that's the reason you had your disclaimer up front. that second part.
Sure. Right.
But as he suggested, Jerry, and he's told me many times that the technicals will tell you where they can go, but the fundamentals will tell you why they go. So I think that's what he's trying to get to, is where do we stand?
And if you go back and listen, you know, over the months, we've had people tell us how much corn we got on stock. We got 2 billion bushels of corn and 450 million bushels of beans. And we've been talking is that this is a mere pittance in the total global situation. And of course, we're hanging our hat on South America increasing and so forth. But it doesn't take much to reduce our production to really wipe out a lot of that. And what Dan said about the 29 out of 30, I look back and I like to look back at most recently, I guess. And actually, as an exception, in 2010, we started going higher on June 30th and into 11, and we didn't top until the following year. So I kind of side with Dan's idea about the you know, I'm not a psychoanalyst per se, but I'm looking at this thing. You've got to, and I think our harvested acres will come down and the yield as well. And you get that trend going, and then you have, that's where you get some concerns. But you need, you're going to need more bean acres, you're going to need more corn acres, and you're certainly going to get more wheat acres. We have clients already in North Dakota want to sell, you know, they're offering them good prices, and they want to lock in some of that spring wheat. They'd like to rotate. But if you get you maybe need 4 million acres of spring wheat out of North Dakota to build a cushion so that you don't run into this problem anytime soon again of being short of premium wheat. Now, where are you going to drag it out? Are you going to drag it out of corn? Are you going to drag it out of beans? They only grow 4 million acres of corn to start with. They take it out of beans. You may not want to give up the beans. So it looks to me like you've got a acreage problem debate coming that nobody really expected a year ago would happen this soon, coming in the next spring, which would then lead you to believe that you don't really know what you got planted. And even like this year, it was kind of a blindside to me. I thought we had a lot less corn and a lot more beans than we did. Now, maybe we'll be proven right again, and not until January. But if that's the case, then you've got to make sure that you've got that incentive to plant that corn in an area that counts, like Iowa and Illinois. And then are beans going to be willing to give up those acres? So that leads to Dan's second analysis, that we could slowly grind this thing higher in a realizing market all the way to June 1st or June 15th of next year to ensure that we incentivize farmers to plant this next year, not to disincentivize them to plant like we did this year and keep the prices, you know, in corn low enough to where we didn't plant as much corn. So, and of course, a lot of that will play out on next week's weather. And it can move quickly. And as far as the gaps goes, why, you know, there are breakaway gaps, and you don't know that they're breakaway gaps until you've had another gap. And then you say, well, that may be the midterm gap. And then after you have another gap, you say, well, these are common gaps. And you can look back and really analyze the thing pretty decently once you've seen all the gaps that didn't get filled. But I think to start out July in an area where we probably exhausted a lot of farmers selling because they've been told to sell any rally, you know, especially by the commercials who want to own the corn at a wide basis. That's a natural thing to do. Now you've probably drained them of any grain, and now they have a problem. I doubt that you're going to see the grain bins open up and see these see farmers rewarding something when it's burning up in their backyard, and it's certainly could be a problem going forward in the weather market. We've been there before.
Well, let me give you some scenarios in the weather market. For instance, the ridge sticks around as a high in North Dakota, which has 1.1 more million soybean acres this year than it did last, and 300,000 more than now, according to USDA's numbers, than it did for intentions. And we get some rains across parts of Iowa and Illinois. What happens if the 1.1 million acres is under drought conditions and really droughty conditions? And what if the ridge moves further to the east, and then we have Illinois or parts of Iowa and a little bit of Illinois that's under the ridge, and that's where we don't get the rain, and they get rain in North Dakota?
Yeah, I think that's the key. I just got a text from a client in Kindred. He said, which is west of Fargo a little ways, still in the red, kind of outskirts of Red River Valley. But if you look at a map and say, where's all the corn and beans planted from a gross bushel standpoint, it's pretty much east of Valley City in that Red River Valley area. You get some smatterings in the northwest, but nothing like you do in the Red River Valley. And they're in pretty decent shape yet. But he said the problem they've had is that it's been windy just about all spring and warm to hot. And he said, we can stand about 2 weeks of this. He said, our crops start going downhill fast because the evaporation rate's been so great because of the winds. And even here in northern Illinois, it's been windy every day. It's kind of nice to get a breeze because you don't get that hot. But that's one underlying theme that we've seen. So if that moves east, then you have a problem similar. And even I think Drew Lerner mentioned the four-letter word 1988 in one of his comments. Some other people are mentioning that as well.
That was in context, Jerry. I'm trying to think about that. That was yesterday. I was in context of what's happening in Montana and North Dakota.
Yeah, and who knows on these weather markets, but I do know what's been happening is that if you look out the 10 to 14 day stuff, it's been consistently hanging in there, which we've been, you know, prior to this time, we've kind of changed things every 5 days. Well, this carrot out there with that heat, And I look at, I monitor Minot, North Dakota, because that's where my son-in-law and daughter farm for 10 days out. There's hardly any rain at all. And that may be the biggest thing if heat doesn't come in there is a lack of rain that could start to hurt a lot of people. And again, you don't need much to change this whole thing. You don't need the whole United States to get into trouble. You just need an area that says we need to reduce the national average down to something more like 166, 164, which by historical standards would be a good yield in corn, and so would 46 bushels an acre in beans. And beans probably look more susceptible now, because even if the pressure goes back, high pressure goes back, is it going to come back in August again? So you got that to deal with. So I don't think it's over by any stretch of imagination, the volatility that we're going to see regardless of the weather.
All right, I'll ask both of you. Old crop corn in the bin, do you want to finish marketing it out? And except for your Vegas bushels, of course, and that's an individual decision. Do you want to finish that off soon enough? I'll start actually with you, Jerry.
I think I would rather use options to protect it. You know, we've been chastised as producers for all year long, you know, of not selling the grain and better sell a 10-cent rally and a 10-cent rally. Well, if you listen to most of the media guys, we'd have been out of corn two or three times by now. The guy that has got the holding power and can use the market carry and so forth, you look at the price they want to pay for fall versus now, I think there's a reason to spend some money on options. I think it's a waste of money a lot of times. I like selling them better than I do buying them. But I think this is, you talk to guys, depending where you're at, and of course, if you're sitting on 240 bushel corn last year, it looks pretty good at any price, and that's what we saw selling. But I like the idea of waiting to see this weather market. It's worth the risk to see what's happening out here, and come Monday or Tuesday morning, you may find out that that's worth and that's the one I think Dan mentioned a couple weeks ago. If this market's going to get better, they're going to go after the crop that is there. They know that they can get, meaning the buyers, at a wide basis already. That's the one that should the September should start to gain, should be on fire. And of course, July is over. But if we can see the old crop start to gain, and we saw a basis pop in Rochelle, Illinois for a couple of days on as if there was some difficulty buying corn. So I like to hold it. In fact, we're long calls so that if it does rally past $4, then we can sell and still be long of anybody that has anything left.
Dan?
One thing that right away this market reminded me of Monday morning, I know it came before 4th of July, but I remember 1983. Now, 1983 is altogether different year fundamentally, I guess. We did have large supplies of corn around, so therefore we had the pick program, so we only had half of a corn crop planted. But I remember 83, we were struggling to get the crop planted. Of course, that was back, you know, when six-row planter was kind of common, or maybe even an eight-row planter was the big dog. But we were struggling to get the crop planted because we had a wet June. And over 4th of July weekend, the weather pattern just flipped. And there was a high pressure sitting right over the center of the country, and it was a so-called Omega block or whatever it was, I remember, and it was the Bermuda high and the Omega block, and we just cooked for basically 6 weeks, and the market just screamed higher. Now, that is something that I think next week may tell us if that high pressure ridge moves to the east and locks in, then we've got, you know, a dandy on our hands. And that was the year the corn went right on up into mid-August and basically topped. It ratted around for another month while soybeans continued to move higher and made their high in September. And then it was all over with, and, you know, the market went back.
But Dan, I remember that because I had grain bins full of CRP reserve corn. You rallied, I think it was 315 or something like that. And then you had a supply that opened up and it danced around down there until it had enough of it out of there. And so we had that, was it 2 billion bushels of reserve corn? I think we had. So we had a supply above the market. That was in Yeah, and it was half of a crop,
I think. It might have been almost, maybe we didn't get to 3 billion until we got to 86, but yes, it was a significantly large supply.
Right. So you knew, when you got there, you were going to get grain, and it danced around up there. And then we closed the reserve up when we had enough, and then went back into the reserve again. Because I remember playing that game of rolling it over. I rolled it over and sold it as new crop, and then replaced the reserve with my new crop grain, and basically got a high price for it. But you don't have that now. You have the only corn that you got holding right now. Some of that's in tight hands, and the rest of it's in farmers' hands that, if you haven't sold by now, you probably don't need the money, and it could become pretty tight, I think, from that. So we just don't have that reserve of grain, other than South America, perhaps, if you could call that a reserve grain. They want to sell their grain, but you know, it's a little different situation, I think, that, you know.
Yes, it's definitely different, but I just wanted to kind of bring it up, basically, the grain, I don't know if you'd want to call it tight hands, if it's in farmer hands or not, but we do have a fairly hefty carryover this year. And if prices would go sharply higher, the question is, how much demand does that choke for the future year or for the 17-18 marketing year? And would the large old crop supply that we have on hand today, would it choke the market like it did in 83, and your high would come, you know, in this August or September time frame, and then but that is just an observation. But yes, you know, it's hard to find 2 years in a row, but the only thing I remember is when this thing popped up Monday, I said, man, this reminds me of 83, because I remember 83 how it popped and the weather pattern flipped. That was the first year I remember the Ring of Fire. I mean, actually, the guys in North and South Dakota probably didn't plant much corn and beans back then, but I know the guys in Minnesota and, you know, far eastern Corn Belt got the rain, where Iowa and Illinois and Indiana just basically choked.
Again, that's exactly what they're talking about with the ridge. At least the meteorologists we've talked to, you know, five of them during the week, and they're all saying fairly close to the same thing, that they're not sure where this high is going to end up sitting. But wherever it hits the outside, that ring, and they haven't used the Ring of Fire just yet, but I suspect they will. They'll be in the Ring of Fire where they do get those rains, but they're not sure whether that will sit. Where it is, has been over the Dakotas, or whether it will move further to the east and drop closer into parts of Iowa. So, and it makes a big difference, because the bottom side of the ring, if it's in the Dakotas, will remain thunderstorms, I suspect. So what haven't we covered that you two want to talk about yet?
I'll go first. I think the What I've seen or heard a lot of emphasis on is that our backdoor, our U.S. stocks, the 2 billion and the 400 million in beans, and how absorbent that is. But, we're in a global situation, and I think your earlier analyst that made the comments earlier before we came on talked about, it's not just the United States. They've got problems in France. They've got problems in Europe. China is maybe not a perfect crop this year. They got some heat problems, and, of course, Australia, and we got Canada. If you look at the global situation, I went back and looked at I look at global demand. I monitor exports by the major and minor exporters in corn and beans both. In corn, there's quite a few, but we average about somewhere close to about a 3% increase in global demand for corn, feed grains probably in total. Just about every country in the world is eating a little more corn. They're certainly eating a lot more soybean equivalent, soybean meal or soybeans to crush them themselves. And you look at a 3% increase for this year. In between 2012 and 2013, we increased exports from 96 million metric tons to 122, or 25% increase. And that was during a time we had high prices. Global demand didn't slow down, because we had Ukraine and Argentina and Brazil came in to fill our void. So we've kept demand. We've done nothing to curb global demand on corn and beans, either one. So, and in beans, we've had 3 years ago, we exported out of the three countries, Brazil and Argentina and the United States, 109 million metric tons. This year, 126 million metric tons. So we're going up about 8 million tons a year. You divide that out, that's about 320-some million bushels, or about 6 million bushels of U.S.-style beans, 6 million acres. Each year, we've got to produce another, say, 4 to 6 million acres of beans globally. Now, is it going to come out of the South America at $8? Probably not. So come next spring, somebody's going to have to increase their, if we don't come in with 700 million carryover. We've got that global increase that keeps creeping up that people don't recognize. And we can see what just happened in wheat when you've got the major sources of hard red winter or premium wheat coming from Canada, United States. Suddenly it dries up. It creates a havoc for a lot of people. So I think we have backdooritis sometimes. You know, we talk about it when we look out our back door and want to market. But I think also from a global perspective, this is a good time to be in agriculture, because we're doing nothing to curb demand globally. From probably 200 and some countries are using more grain each year, a little bit more. And they're going to do that at $3.50, $4 cash corn in the United States, $4 corn, and certainly something under $10 beans. And I don't think you'd get much expansion of acres unless it comes from South America, really, and maybe the Ukraine and those areas, but that takes time over there. So that's the thing I keep looking at, is that next year, what are we going to be looking at, and what kind of demand, and are we going to be able to meet that with without incentivizing South America to do even more?
Yeah, and I was looking at it the opposite way, thinking the guys in the Dakotas might want to turn back to wheat, and I wasn't thinking about demand being so large. I guess, I mean, they put 1.1 million more acres of soybeans in. That's a lot, and they put more corn in. They changed a lot of acres over.
Yeah. And they didn't have any prevent plant this year to speak of. That was kind of a surprise. There are some in our farm in north of Aberdeen. We had a quarter of land that was potholes. And, of course, that was any excuse you could take out of production. You got paid $250 an acre for PP. That's better than planting anything. But I think that's the any PP will have to come from Illinois and Indiana and those areas. But so we've kind of maxed up. I think that's where some of these acres came from. I was surprised that they planted corn in North Dakota with an 82-cent basis. My goodness, what are they thinking? Maybe we're way wrong in our cost of production. But yeah, if you're going to pull 4 million acres out of there next year for spring wheat, and Informa's got the spring wheat carryover down to about 120 million. Well, we talked to guys in Europe. They're already at 75 million without a drop in harvested acres. The elevators in Canada and northern North Dakota tell me that carryover in spring wheat could virtually go to zero. Well, you're going to get desire for that to a bigger cushion next year. They don't want to have another crop problem. And so you're going to try to buy some acres.
I got a second question about spring wheat, and I haven't looked this up yet just to see what it was they had in storage and how much they store, and whether spring wheat is a contracted product in the Dakotas like barley is.
No, spring and wheat, they'll store it forever if they have to. I mean,
right.
You know, and that's so, what we don't know is how much was there, but a lot of wheat came to market in North Dakota.
So my experience with my experience out of there tells me that they're probably delivering 15 wheat.
Yep.
At this 15 wheat, not 16 wheat.
Right.
And they may have 16 wheat still stored.
Yeah. But and that's the case. That was how we grew up. My dad's marketing program was he didn't sell anything until he saw this year's crop. And they didn't, you know, they didn't like debt and all that stuff, because they knew once every 4 years you got a crop problem, a drought even. And, you know, of course, all that changed 30 years ago, perhaps. But, they kept when you take wheat to market in North Dakota, why, they find every excuse to dock you. So if you took $5.50 wheat in, you could have a $1.60 dock. Well, I remember turning right around with our truck and heading home with it and said, you know, my dad said, I'll store it till you want it. If it's too much premium, they dock you. If it's not enough premium, they dock you. And, so farmers got sick of it, you know, and planting probably half the wheat we used to plant. And it's become almost a specialty crop up there. But now there's the desire to want to do it because of rotation. And They'll pull some acres in. We've got clients already that want to sell cash contracts. Nobody wants to talk about an act of God clause because they want the wheat. You're going to contract it. We want it. You're going to find it somewhere, you know, so they got to be careful doing that. But nobody knows how much wheat is sitting there because you lose track of it. But I don't think it's that much, but that's going to overwhelm the market. But they certainly came to the elevator with it.
Anything to add, Dan?
I guess question, what soft, I forget what spring wheat is used for. What's the primary use of that? Is that for the pasta and stuff, or is that another wheat?
Durum is pasta, and spring wheat is your quality bread. The Eastern European countries, Black Sea region, you know, the Europeans like good wheat. When you go buy a $5 loaf of bread and it's heavy, that's likely made, and whole wheat bread is made out of spring wheat, and Durum is the pasta area. They've learned to blend that a little bit because that the average bear, you know, goes to get the, you know, honey whole wheat bread or something. You can't, you know, that's whole wheat, but it's not like that heavy stuff that the private guys made, that, you know, the specialty wheat guys in the United States. But Europe likes it, and the Eastern Europeans, the Iranians, Moroccans, and so forth, you know, the pita bread and all that, some of that stuff is, it's pretty high quality stuff. When you can taste the grains in there, you can taste it pretty well, and it's a, you know, it's good quality wheat. The junk we eat here, the white bread, is made out of 8 and 9% protein that we grow in Illinois, the soft red bundt wheat. They call it junk wheat in North Dakota because it's about what it is. You know, it's not even good enough for pot.
What's the price of Durum done?
It's high. It always seems to be higher than protein, and of course the Durum, I mean, than the spring wheat, and that's the way it is pretty consistently, unless there's just an awful lot of high protein wheat. And then they of course don't pay the premium. So they pay so much a point or a half point, as it can be as much as 25 cents per half point of protein, you know, and average protein in North Dakota is about 14%. The 15 pro will bring you more money, even much, sometimes a buck and a quarter, if there isn't much of it per bushel. Whereas in Illinois, I think we had 10%, and even the hard red winter wheat isn't as good as a protein, a high protein wheat in North Dakota and Canada. And I looked up, talked to guys in Europe, and we questioned, well, where can you get high protein wheat? The majority of it's going to come from the United States and Canada. Canada especially, and they've got problems of their own. It's dry enough up there. The canola crop is hurting too, so that's a little more susceptible than spring wheat. But if you want good quality wheat, you come to us or Canada, or Black Sea region has some. But you got to be careful. They make their protein wheat based on the wet matter, not on dry matter. And of course, the equivalent is still makes U.S. wheat the best wheat in the world, and Canada especially.
So again, I have another question, and maybe either of you can answer this. Why did Dakota farmers decide to plant so many acres of beans this year? So many extra acres of soybeans.
You can lock in a profit. Take a look at say 60 cent basis, and then if you plant the crop and it gets to be late, and you start to pay 60 cents a bushel to dry it, it just doesn't work. These guys are pretty sick of it. And if you look at the stocks in all positions, I think, you know, the South Dakota, North Dakota, Minnesota guy probably storing a lot of that. The Northern Plains had maybe a greater percentage than last year. And we had, and if they were corn on corn, you could plant beans, and they had a good bean crop last year, exceptional bean crop. And so they were using that in some of their cash flows and saying, well, these new technology seeds will give us 3 to 5 bushels an acre. My son-in-law said that. He went from, I think, 2,500 acres of beans last year to 6,000 acres this year. And he cut canola out completely, and sunflowers and anything else, because there just wasn't an alternative that paid as much. You could lock in a profit with beans, even at your APH, whereas in corn, you couldn't. But guys planted it, you know, anyway, corn, you know.
And more so than they could with wheat. I'm driving towards is trying to figure out if they would come back out of that, or if North Dakota was going to remain. I mean, they planted, 7.2 million acres of soybeans?
Yeah.
They're a player in the bean market.
And they also know what happens to spring wheat when you plant it on last year's bean crop. It gives another kick, you know, like we've learned here, corn on bean ground is you know, 20 bushels better on average or 30 than what corn on corn is. And they'll go in there and with a air seeder, and they won't even work the ground this fall. They just go in air seed it in the spring, and you've got nitrogen already. So and most of them planted the beans and sold them.
So you think they'll have a two crop rotation in parts of North Dakota, soybeans and spring wheat.
Yeah, spring wheat will come, and unless they plant too much, and then it goes back down to $5 again or less, and then they'll plant beans again if beans are, you know, $9 on the board of trade gets them eight something a bushel, and that works at 36 to 40 bushel an acre. And
reallocation.
Yeah.
And because price is high enough. See, here's the other thing, is that price is high enough to reallocate acres, right?
Yeah,
I mean, it is.
Yeah,
it's done it already.
To be doing that, that's what we wanted to. We always were told as farmers, take your clue from the market. The market will tell you what it wants. Well, it didn't want spring wheat for the last 3 years or last 4 or 5 years. You look at it, and it's a long way from $25 a bushel down to 3.5 or 4. You know.
And your argument is that more allocation has to come.
Market
at this point,
need
but
it.
That'll be driven by the world.
Yeah, they're already contracting. We've got clients can contract for over $7 a bushel for spring wheat for next year. And
why does this have to happen in other parts of the world? I mean, why wouldn't it just happen in the United States? We've had three meaning corn acres go down, as they have, more corn acres go down. Illinois farmers already did this. They already lowered their Illinois farmers are ahead of the crew.
Yeah, I think it can happen anywhere. And that may be a surprise that's out there, or the unknown that keeps the market guessing as to what are these guys in other parts of the country going to do, you know. Certainly they're going to want to plant more wheat in France because they've got a pretty bad crop, and maybe next year the Ukraine says, heck with this corn at $4 a bushel on the board of trade, we'll plant some $7 spring wheat. And that, you know, they used to be the breadbasket of the world in that area. So it could, that's why when you start looking ahead and doing some what ifs and allocations, the guys in Europe that I talked to the commercial guy, they're really concerned that they're going to be able to find enough premium wheat. And how do we incentivize enough wheat to be grown so that we don't have to pay $10 a bushel for wheat, that we can, you know, we'd rather pay incentivize a little bit more to get the acres planted so we can pay $3 a bushel less when harvest comes, but give the farmer an incentive because he likely won't sell it ahead of time anyway very much. And but I think these farmers now in North Dakota, I've been pushing them, and they said there's some talk about it, that it's an act of God's laws. All right, I will sell you 40 bushels an acre or 50 bushels or whatever, 80% of my APH at $7.50 a bushel. If I don't get it, I don't have to come up with it if it's a weather problem. If I get 75 bushels, I take whatever the market is at that time for that extra 20 bushels an acre that I didn't contract. And they do that in barley now. Your daughter works in that area, so my son-in-law plants barley. It's if he gets it, then he that's the price he gets. If he gets more than he contracted, then he takes whatever they want to pay him. And because they're really concerned about, you know, how they discount the blazes out of spring wheat.
You've been quiet, Dan.
Well, I'm ridiculously bullish soybeans.
Yeah,
so I find it interesting. I find.
Well, you see where I've been trying to ride this one.
We're playing into your hands.
My take on the soybean market, things could get real interesting because if beans go sharply higher, then there's going to be, you know, corn's going to get left in the dust as far as the incentive to have corn acres at least early or like this fall and early winter. So then it would be corn's function over the next 6 to 8 months would be to grind higher to try to avoid a big drop in corn acres if soybeans would explode to the upside, and you already got the spring wheat areas
contracting next year's wheat crop. So, at least listening to Jerry, it sounds like you're losing bean acres in the spring wheat crop. And I think soybean prices could go sharply higher. Now, I got to have some fundamental things kind of go my way. But I think the soybean market is in the early stages of a major bull market that could go higher right on into October. And the thing that beans have different than corn is where the cash shorts are at. Nearly every farmer advisory service, and I can't necessarily criticize them for doing so, was advising farmers to sell $10 beans last winter. Your grain companies that are offering all of these derivative contracts and alternative marketings where they're actually in the advisory business, they have been advising farmers to sell $10 soybeans. And I was even surprised to see some academia extension advisors even get on that bandwagon too. Usually they're a little mellower on giving advice, but they were quite animately in the opinion that farmers should sell $10 beans. And I'm in the opinion that a market doesn't give you 2-3 months to sell the high. It only gives you 5 seconds to sell the high.
Exactly.
So, and then I think the commercial grain trade is short beans.
Yeah.
And if this thing, all of a sudden, this weather pattern would shorten up this bean crop, and I mean, that's all we spent all spring talking about 500, 600 million bushel carryovers, you know. So that's where all the shorts are at. And the market is right now knocking on their door. And that's why next week's weather is so important. Because if you would plow through that, then all of a sudden the shorts are all going to start panicking and trying to figure out a way to get out of the market, and then they could chase it higher. And I noticed there was a weather firm called Weather Risk made the comment there yesterday or something on one of the Twitter wires that if the current weather pattern stays in place, and I'm not too sure what they mean by the current weather pattern, but they suggested that we have a much higher than average probability of having a much earlier than normal frost this year.
Right.
And of course, guys that have been listening to me with my sunspots theory, That goes along with that scenario, and that was one of the reasons why we had such a cold spring, I believe. We even had late frost, but the planting was so late that the late frost didn't do any damage. But if we would get an extremely early frost with a lot of the crop at least two weeks late in many of the northern areas, and
three inch beans last week in North Dakota, and a lot of them.
Well, sure, I'll tell you, you could easily say that the upper third of the Corn Belt is more vulnerable to an early frost than they normally would be this year. So if that would come into play, man, this bean market, we would try out expanded limits gains a couple days in a row. And that would take out all the cash shorts.
if you want a fundamental reason for it, if you got a fundamental reason for it, and we're stuck with this 89 million acre thing that the USDA came out with, and probably until October, who knows if they change it in August or September, they may, but October when they 578s come through from farmers reporting, that's probably when we'll know that we maybe planted more beans. But until then, we're stuck with it. But 2 bushels an acre, informers at 48 bushels an acre, yet they're scared to go out on a limb on anything. But 2 bushels an acre loses 176 million bushels. That takes your carry out down from 513 to 337. And I just mentioned that our demand globally goes up about 328 million a year. You needed 89 million and a good crop. You can't afford a 2 bushel drop in it. And the guys in Europe told me, you get if you print a 46 bushel bean yield, he says you've got $12 beans. He said it in a heartbeat, because you need that many much more. And now you've got, can South America grow another big one like that? And if they go to beans, will they rob corn and so forth? But you know, 500 million bushels isn't a lot of beans in the United States anymore. And if you would have this happen in September without a frost, then like you say, you're knocking on the door. You better have perfect weather from here in the beans with these acres. If we'd have had 91.5 million acres, then you got some cushion. But yield is a lot more important when you got 90 million acres than what acres are. You know, a yield 2 bushels.
And on the cautionary note side, it's one user, unlike corn in the United States, where the bulk of it is used here, we send an unbelievable amount of the soybeans out of the country.
Right.
To one user. And so does South America. All going to China.
Yep. Oh, no. 40% of the increase in demand in the last 10 years has been non-Chinese demand. So you can attribute 60% of it, and everybody's kind of hung up on that. But just you go back, and I get informant stuff. I pay good money for it, you know, and it shows every country out there. And you can look at where were you 10 years ago and where you're at now. Like we've gone from 83 million metric ton total exports by the major guys, South America, North America, to 153 in 10 years. That's 150% increase. And 60% of that is China, 40% somewhere else. So I don't know if you know of Alltech, but if you can check on their website, Alltech is a feed supplier worldwide. And I know them pretty well. And they said of the 100 and some countries that they monitor, feed usage has gone up, protein and feed grain usage has gone up in every one of those countries a little bit. Everybody is growing another cow or feeding another cow or expanding their herd, especially in the eastern areas, you know, Vietnam and Indonesia and so forth, where global demand had just been increasing, you know, slowly, but in protein more so, and in corn about maybe 3% a year. But 3% of a big number is a big number, and 5% of a big number is a big number in beans. So where do you find that incremental increase? You know what I'm getting at? It's kind of like complaining about our economy and saying, well, 2% GDP, that's terrible. Well, 2% now is like 4% was 20 years ago or whatever. Same way with China, you know, 6% number of a big number. It's that incremental increase in bushels. Where is that going to come from? And you don't expand the acres at $8 a bushel in South America or the U.S. You do it at $9, $10, or $13, or $14 a bushel. And I think some of this stuff now is inelastic. I think you could take look at a meal chart. You know, I failed in buying meal. We fixed our wide basis in meal, but I fell asleep on buying meal for end users. And that sucker's gone straight up. And you look at canola, that's gone straight up. That's an oil seed. And all this happened, even though Trump did us no favors at all with biodiesel or with any of that or ethanol or anything, he totally flubbed it. You know, the oil guys won on that one. and yet the price is going up anyway. So there's something in behind the scenes that, you know, going to help us. And, you know, those guys over in China start eating some good quality beef, and they eat corn, you know. And Dan, I got to hold myself back from being too bullish, you know, in beans, because I hear this other stuff, and yet I try to concentrate on the future, you know.
Well, the tamp things down a little bit here.
Wait.
I got some wind, I'll tell you, Dan.
50 minutes in.
I view the high that we had here in this, you know, whether, you know, you want 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, as a 27-year cycle high. So I think the long-term trend on the 27-year cycle is basically down into 2023, 2025, because you kind of go 13 years up, you go 13 years down. So I would view this as a retracement rally back toward those 12 highs. It would be something, what I would call as, for those that were around in 1973, 74, we had our major highs, and then we had decline into 77, and then we had the recovery rally back to 80, and then we went into 6 years of declining markets until we finally hit bottom in the mid 80s, which was a 27-year cycle low. So I would say that if we do go have a weather kicker in here, something I would almost kind of say this could be something like the 1980, or this is the 1983 recovery rally of the decline that we had from 1980 to 82. And then we went on down into our major lows there in 85 and 86 and 87. So, I guess that's what I'd want to tamp down. If we do go prices sharply higher, that will expand acreage, reduce, you know, high prices are to expand production and to reduce demand. And that's what would happen. And then that would send us lower into the 20s and that type of thing. So,
well, to be clear, the only thing we've only talked about at $12 is the highest thing we've heard. And I'm assuming you're talking $12 to $13, something like
well,
that.
Well, how high? I forget how high we went in 12.
I was going to say 16 or 17.
17, yeah, something 15, like that. 17 so, for sure. So we got, doing we got whether or not you want to be. Yeah, whether or not it wants to be 12 or 13, somewhere along the line, those $10 cash beans are going to look low, cheap. And that's what my hashtag is. What's wrong with making $10 beans look cheap? So I don't know. I mean, I hope the audience realizes that, you know, predicting the future is kind of a loser's game. But, you know, Jerry and I are trying to project out some longer term thinking here. Now, how that helps them, every farmer has to kind of decide how they want to weave through the race course here. But it's definitely going to be a race course, and it's going to be a deep pocket game for hedgers and whatnot. And it's going to be tense at times, I guess, and it all depends upon what next week's weather is.
Yeah, and I think we've some of the larger farmers, you know, the mega farmers, it costs a lot of money to do that, and we've seen a lot of cases where there just isn't money for a good hedging program, and maybe we've learned, you know, what cash flow is all about. To where there's a line item in your balance sheet that says I need to invest some money, and I call it an investment, not a cost investment, in marketing expertise, either learning it yourself or getting a hold of somebody that does well at it and gives you something more information to think about and to be able to lock in that. And one of the best places is on farm storage. And I think we're seeing that. I know the guys in North Dakota that said, well, if corn's going to do, you know, if corn goes down and we got to see sub $3 cash corn, then they'll hold that corn and they'll plant something else and reduce the acres. You know, they'll wait for an opportunity, because usually like every 3 or 4 years, we get an opportunity to make money on something that's in the bin. But you got to have deep pockets, and you got to have, you know, reduce your debt in the good years so that you can handle the bad years. And that's probably
one observation that I learned. working for the commercial grain companies for 8 years, is when they stop buying your grain, that's probably the end of the market.
Yep. Yep.
And when they pull their bids, that's probably it.
Well, that's important then. I mean, important now.
Well, it is, because basically when they pull their bids, and like I said, this is something that I've observed watching them, is that means that they're basically out of cash flow. I mean, their margins to the hilt, and they're scared to death to buy new crop inventories because they're afraid to death that farmers won't fulfill those contracts because there's no equity, or there's no equity in hedge to arrive contracts. And that's what happened back in 2008 when everybody was pulling their bids in the wintertime. Farmers were wanting to sell new crop corn and new crop beans. But the problem was is that there's no equity behind those. And the finance people in the commercial grain trade they're finance people. They say, well, you don't have, you know, this is something that you don't even know if the farmer's going to be able to raise next year. And we're hedging this. We're sending money to Chicago on this. And that's what happened back in the double O's when we first went up. So that is something farmers need to be watchful for if history would repeat itself, if that would happen again. If grain companies begin to get cold feet and stop buying new crop grain, that tells you that they're worried that that is not a good hedge, or that hedge has a high degree risk of maybe not being fulfilled. And we all know that if we go to those prices, somebody's going to be hurt financially. And that farmer that was maybe farming 2,000 acres, he may not be farming a year from now because he lost it all and somebody else is farming and those contracts aren't any good. So that's what worries grain companies on that.
On that note, I think we'll wrap it up. Hey, thanks, guys.
Okay, very well. Thank you. Take care, Jerry.